Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by a grant from International Galleries in Urbana's Lincoln Square Mall, offering functional stoneware, hand-carved boxes, meditation statuary, candles, and incense. International Galleries also offers custom framing services for your fine art print, photos, needlework, and fabric art. Rush service is always available.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stenzel, Jason Croft is at the controls. Just a quick mention of tomorrow morning on the show. In the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about dreaming and what science has learned over the last roughly 50 years about dreams. And our guest for the program will be Andrea Rock. She is an award-winning medical and science reporter and is author of a recently published book titled The Mind at Night, The New Science of Dreaming and the New Science of How and Why We Dream. That's the subtitle for the show. It looks at some of the research that's been done since the 1950s, beginning with the discovery of REM sleep, and then looking at some of the present-day theories about what dreaming is all about, why it is we dream, what it does for us. That'll be in the first part of the show. Hour number two, we will do one of those programs that we call Talk to the Manager. We haven't done it in quite some time. And occasionally, we like to have on our acting station manager, program director, Jay Pierce, to take questions and comments people have about the programs that they hear on our stations. We're always interested in what you think. And you can do that. You can call in and tell us tomorrow morning on the show in the 11 o'clock hour. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be spending some time talking a bit about forests and forest ecology, and taking as our case study the forests of the Northeast. Back when Henry David Thoreau was rambling around New England in the 19th century, he wrote a lot about the region's natural beauty. One thing he lamented was the lack of woodlands and the wildlife that went with them. He and others believed that New England's forests would never recover from the kind of broad and deep cutting that had been done as it had been settled and turned into farmland. Today, however, things are very different. In fact, New England is one of the most heavily forested regions in the United States. Many things have acted upon the forests of New England over the last millennium or so. Some powerful weather, in addition, diseases and insects, and of course, human beings. All of these things help to make the forest the place that it is today. And scientists say that if we're going to understand today's environment, well, we have to understand the history, what's gone before. That is true for the forests of the Northeast, and I'm sure it's also true for the prairie and just about any place else, for that matter. For about a century now, scientists at Harvard have been studying forest ecology, using as their laboratory a little plot of some 3,000 acres known as the Harvard Forest. And this morning, in this part of the show, we will be talking with the director, the current director of the Harvard Forest. His name is David Foster. He is also principal investigator of the long-term ecological research program there at Harvard. It's one of 25 national centers for ecological research that's funded by the National Science Foundation. He's also one of the contributors to a book that has recently been published. It's titled Forests in Time, The Environmental Consequences of 1,000 Years of Change in New England, and it's published by the Yale University Press. He's joining us this morning to be with us in this hour of Focus 580. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, Mr. Foster, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Appreciate it. So how is it that your Harvard book gets published by Yale? Something's odd about that.
Well, no, we've published in various venues, and Yale was prepared to do a good job with this work.
Right. Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Tell us about the Harvard Forest.
So, as you say, the Harvard Forest is 3,000 acres out in central Massachusetts, in the forested and very rural part of Massachusetts. It is a research and educational institute established by the university around the turn of the century, almost 100 years ago. And it's been focused on environmental studies, which has lent itself to becoming one of the longest long-term records of environmental change and forest development in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Broadly speaking, how have things there changed over time? And I guess the one obvious thing, just to me, from the cursory looking over the material in the book, is that there was a big change over this period of time that that Europeans have been in the region, that initially caused an awful lot of trees to be cut down, and that's leads us to that observation that Thoreau made. But then we do see a period of recovery, something like maybe 100 years after Thoreau, the forests were back. Now, they might have been different, but maybe you can talk about what has happened, sort of a thumbnail sketch of what's happened overall, say, over the last maybe few hundred years.
Sure. Broadly, the frontier of the United States, that is the European frontier of the United States, has continued to move westward. Initially, New England was the frontier, and it was the focus of extensive deforestation by people who were interested in living off the land. So these were Europeans, largely from Britain to begin with, who wanted to clear the forest to create a landscape that was reminiscent of the British Isles. They cut down the forest. They burned up the residual material. They planted the land and then grazed it very extensively. And by and large, they thought that they would, they and their ancestors would be on that land forever. But of course, the frontier moved further west, and as it did, other agricultural opportunities arose. And so agriculture and transportation led to a transformation in the economy of the United States, which undercut the farming potential of New England. When that happened, and that was coincident with Henry Thoreau's life, people started moving westward to farm, and they started moving inward into urban settings in the East Coast, by and large abandoning their agricultural lifestyles in New England. That led to a widespread 100-year period when the New England landscape went from farmland back into forest. And that's what's given rise to this really remarkable expanse of forest land that we have today.
When you look at the various species that make up the forest today and what you know about what had been there before Europeans came and there was a lot of cutting to convert it to agricultural land, how are those two forests different? Because I would imagine that that what was there 1,000 years ago was different from what's there today. Or are they that different?
Yeah, it depends very much on your perspective. In a broad way, it's remarkable that we have the same mixture of species, the same relative abundance of native species, and very few, for example, non-native invasive tree species. On the other hand, when you look at it closely, which is what we do as ecologists, the numbers are different. The relative abundance of, for example, the old growth species, the long-lived mature forest species, they've dropped considerably, and the landscape is by and large more heavily populated with species which are opportunists, which take advantage of the amount of disturbance that we've had in the landscape over the last few hundred years, and so their numbers have increased. So it depends very much on your perspective. Overall, from a distance, the landscape is very similar to what it would have been many hundred years ago.
Mm-hmm. That, and you could certainly understand that since we're only talking about a century things that would take much longer than that to reach full maturity wouldn't be there anymore. But I guess I am a little bit surprised that you don't have a greater problem with non-native things that would take advantage of the fact that there was a niche there to get into, and that you wouldn't have a real problem, particularly with things that are really those things that are really non-native and very invasive. That you do, obviously, you do see it elsewhere around the United States. You certainly see it in the Midwest.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. I guess what I'd say is two things. One, we certainly have had the invasion, if you will, of non-native insects and pathogens, which have actually caused the decline and, in some cases, the near removal of some species. Chestnut is a notable example. Elm is another example, although it wasn't anywhere near as abundant as chestnut was. We currently now have an Asian insect which is killing off our hemlock trees. So there have been some declines as a result of the impacts of non-native insects and pests and pathogens. I think New England is fortunate in the fact that all of this history that we're talking about, this reforestation, occurred relatively early. It really did start in the 1850s, and much of it transpired before the turn of the 20th century. And as a result, the number and abundance of invasive plant species was relatively small, and people have conjectured as to what would have happened if, for example, New England were abandoned from agriculture today with the large number of invasive plant species that we have, and we might actually get a very different story. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's a matter of history playing out and some of the vagaries of the history making a lot of difference in terms of what we actually get as an outcome.
Mm. I would imagine that today, if you you had a region that had been at one time heavily forested, and then there had been a lot of cutting and it had been converted to agricultural land, and then you decided that you were going to try to restore what it was, that a lot of wildlife experts and biologists and ecologists and plant people would at least give some thought to how to help that process along, and would consider it probably appropriate maybe to do a little bit of grooming in the way that 100 years ago it would never happen. It was just left, and nature did its thing. I guess I'm interested in how it is that if now we were going to do it now, would science be applied, and how would science be applied? Because I'm sure that it wouldn't, if such a thing was going to be undertaken as a project, it wouldn't just be left alone, and maybe the outcome wouldn't be all that desirable. Even if you did just leave it alone, maybe we wouldn't all be all that happy with what you would get actually.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Last week I was interviewed by a BBC program that was interested in examining what would happen to the British Isles and northwestern Europe if some of the plans by the European Commission were to unfold, which would result in major reforestation of a lot of agricultural land in Europe. And they wanted to know what lessons there were from New England. And one of the obvious differences between what would happen today in Europe and what happened 150 years ago in New England is that today, as that were to unfold in Britain or Europe, it certainly wouldn't be a haphazard process that people ignored. It would be something that people would manage. In contrast, in New England, this was a process in which people were leaving the land and they weren't looking back over their shoulders. And so it unfolded just in the way that the biology and the nature of the individual species and the landscape dictated. There was very, very little intervention by people. And so I think you're absolutely right. If we were to have a similar process in the eastern U.S. today, we'd try to bring all of our expertise and management skills to nudging it in different directions, as we tend to do. That wasn't the case a century and a half ago.
So actually, when you look at how things turned out, it sounds like in spite of absence of nudging, things turned out pretty well, at least in this particular case. But it sounds like you can't generalize from that to what would happen today if you designed a similar sort of experiment.
Yeah, well, the scale is really difficult to grasp. I mean, this was certainly a process that unfolded in New England, but it's broadly characteristic of the entire eastern United States. Mm-hmm. If you go to North Carolina, go to Raleigh-Durham, and walk around the landscape of the Duke Forest, for example, with its director, he will tell a story that's almost identical to New England. The individuals are different. The crops that were grown were different. The climate and the species are different. But this is a broad-scale change in the economy, social values, and the landscape that transpired across much of the eastern U.S. As a consequence, you know, it's unlike anything that we could conceive of doing today, or even anything that is being conceived of in Europe today. It did, as you say, result in something quite phenomenal, which is the reestablishment of native species and native forests all across the region. And one of the things that we like to point out is that in many ways that gives people in the eastern U.S. A second opportunity to decide what they want to do with their forested landscape.
Hmm. Perhaps I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. David Foster is professor of biology at Harvard University, and he is also director of the Harvard Forest and its long-term ecological research program. The Harvard Forest was established by the university in 1907 as a center for forest research and education in central Massachusetts. He is also the author, one of the authors of, contributors to, a book that looks at some of what he and other scientists have learned about the forests of Massachusetts and how they have changed over time. The title is Forests in Time, The Environmental Consequences of 1,000 Years of Change in New England. And the book is published by the Yale University Press. And people who are listening, if you have questions, you certainly are welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about some of the factors, natural and otherwise, that have helped to shape the forest there in Massachusetts. And weather certainly has been one of those, notably hurricanes. There have been a number of hurricanes, and I guess one of the recent ones, the big ones, was in the late 1930s. It was 38, I think.
That's right.
Yeah. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that, how that kind of weather, what it has done to change the things over time.
Yeah, well, I think the broad perspective is that in our endeavors to understand the landscape in the forest, we really try to look at the wide range of processes that are and have been operative. And so you look at the human history that we've just been talking about, but then you look at natural events, climate change, and various kinds of meteorological events. You look at earlier people and so on. Without any doubt, certainly one of the important disturbance processes in our landscape is hurricanes. And these occur frequently, but the major kind of catastrophic ones that blow down broad expanses of forests and disrupt people's lives and change the structure of landscapes really only occur on the order of every century. Now, that sounds infrequent, but in the lifetime of trees that live three or four centuries, clearly these are something to be reckoned with. We've tried to interpret the history and impact of these storms, and we've come to find out that, you know, through time, starting right after the Mayflower landed and coming right through to the recent time, there have been these storms. The 1938 hurricane is one of the most important because it's recent in memory, and it also happens to be one of the largest in history. It swept through New England. It blew down forests over 150 miles in length and about 75 to 100 miles in width. Had a huge impact on livelihoods and has structured our forests in ways that will be evident for another 100 years at least. Mm.
Is there a big difference between what happens when, let us say, a hurricane comes through and blows down trees and what happens when human beings come through and cut the trees down?
Oh, absolutely. Human beings, of course, cut the trees down with a purpose, and the purpose is either to remove the wood and allow the forest to regrow or to clear the land and establish some other kind of land use. So the human impact not only ends up with the mortality of the trees and the dropping of the individual trees under the ground, but major reconfigurations of the structure and oftentimes the ecology of the forest. These hurricanes that come through certainly do a tremendous amount of structural damage. They don't remove any of the material from the forest, and so as a consequence, you have actually a fairly remarkable and rapid recovery of a variety of processes in the forest and characteristics in the forest that lend themselves to the reestablishment of a forest ecosystem very quickly.
We have a caller who would like to come into the conversation here. We welcome that. People who are listening, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Charleston to talk with on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes. The forest, as we know it, and human impacts upon those entities, and what I see or perceive as a tidal wave of humanity coming that is going to destroy the ecological system on this globe. 6 billion people are projected, 12 billion people, if urbanization and the manufacture for human consumption, all these things come from natural resources, and I can't perceive that any lasting recovery of the sorts that you've been talking about. And further, when if I understand photosynthesis, that's where we get our oxygen, and when the source of that oxygen is removed or decimated, and then we fill that void with pollution. I mean, we so far, you know, stand 6 or so feet above the earth, and the pollution is above us as a rule. But when it becomes so dense, and the deforestation, all those other things, and human population, do you have any thoughts about those things?
So I think the direction you're going is a important and critical one, which is we don't look at the history of any particular landscape, for example, New England and its remarkable recovery, with kind of blinders and full optimism. What we do is we recognize it as one story in a very much larger story, which, as you suggest, includes the gradual, ongoing, continual deforestation and modification of the Earth's surface. Nonetheless, the fact that we do have this particular story and this particular landscape gives us in the eastern United States an opportunity to reflect on its history within the larger global context. But I think, without any doubt, we don't sit back quietly and assume that there's a rosy picture in the future. There are dire consequences of the kind of environmental change that we've had have seen and that are ongoing in the on the Earth.
Thank you.
All right. Other calls with questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We started out talking about some of the various forces that come to alter the forest, weather, extreme sort of weather events like a hurricane is one of them. As any place, there are also problems with insects and diseases, and like other places in the country, the forests there in New England and Massachusetts have been affected by things like the gypsy moth, and there's been Dutch elm disease, and you talked about the fact that now recently there's an Asian insect that's causing a lot of problems with hemlock trees. I think it's interesting to me that apparently if you look at most of these things, the plant diseases, insect problems, they most of them were introduced. They came from someplace else. They weren't things that sprung up there in the region.
You know, I think the overall history of this landscape has actually been a combination of local indigenous activities, some of those wrought directly by people. Currently now we have, of course, major stress on our forests coming from the deposition of nitrogen compounds, a big fertilizing effect on our forests as a result of fossil fuel combustion. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, many of these things ultimately are brought to us from outside of the region. I mean, ultimately, of course, European arrival is the first hallmark of that. Mm-hmm. But with successive waves of people and materials brought in, we're constantly bombarding our landscape with new stresses, with new organisms, with new challenges, which it's having to confront. And all of that leads to an ongoing dynamic and change in the landscape, which is leading to continually new conditions for us.
Yeah. We have some other callers here. Someone in Atlanta, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Interesting conversation. You might have covered this. I might have missed it, but hopefully I didn't. In the recovery of the forest of New England, what about animal life, particularly birds? Did bird nesting come back to be similar to what it had been before the immigrants came in and leveled everything? And how is that today compared to older species of birds and, of course, other animals and mammals, which are animals? And what do you think?
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject and a great question. The transformations have occurred in wildlife in general in the New England landscape and eastern U.S. are absolutely remarkable. And it poses not only a number of basic scientific questions like the one that was just framed, but it leads to very, very interesting management and almost ethical questions. In terms of the specifics of your question on recovery, I can only offer, and I think anybody can only offer, an incomplete answer. We don't have a comprehensive enumeration and summary of the species that were here in the 1500s or earlier. But what we have seen is a remarkable recovery of native fauna, woodland fauna, and a tremendous recovery of, in particular, of woodland bird species. We have extensive areas of forest. They're getting older and more mature. And as a consequence, we are supporting increasingly large numbers of woodland bird species. Very gradually, we're also starting to attract a lot of woodland mammal species. And you've got to put this in perspective. I mean, when Henry Thoreau was traipsing across the Massachusetts landscape, he lamented the lack of large mammals and native wildlife, and he made a declaration that the single largest wildlife species in eastern Massachusetts was the muskrat. Well, we now have a landscape that not only has deer and newly arrived coyotes, but has black bear and fishers and bobcats and a rapidly growing population of moose. And so we're reestablishing wildlife both purposely by reintroducing them ourselves, but also inadvertently just by creating the habitat that allows them to move in the landscape. The ethical dilemma and the management issue that arises is that there are whole suites of species that were characteristic of the landscape in Henry Thoreau's time who thrive on open lands, who thrive in grasslands and shrublands and thickets and young forests. And all of those species, including quintessential bird species of the New England landscape like meadowlarks and bobolinks and so on, are declining, and they're actually becoming rare and uncommon. And so the question that arises is, what should we do to about our landscape to both accommodate the new arrivals of woodland species and deal with the losses of these open land species, which are decreasing?
Well, this argument is really relevant to me. We live on a 400-acre farm that part of it's been designated as a nature preserve, and we're trying to restore the rest of it. It's in a real hilly area, and of course, at one time, it was all timber ground, and of course, the soil reflects that. But because of the loss of diversity around the farm, there used to be a lot big expanses of marshes, and of course, the prairie coming up against the timber here along the little creek that runs through the farm, those have all been lost. So we have developed some, 70 or 80 acres of really nice tall grass prairie, and under new government mandates they would rather see that timber, and we have been able, due to some endangered species being in that grasslands, been able to save that. But my whole argument has been that, yeah, it's good to put a lot of it back in timber, but we need to maintain some of that diversity, because there is no other diversity outside this area. And that's exactly what you're talking about in New England, that as it all becomes timber again, you lose your slowly. At one time, there wasn't any diversity because there wasn't any timber, but now as the timber's come back, you had a lot of diversity, and now that's going too.
Yeah, I agree completely, and I've written some articles which have tried to look at the New England landscape very, very broadly and argue that in a sense, if we were wise and planning and thinking in a regional perspective, which of course we aren't, we could actually have it all. That is, we could have a broadly forested landscape. We could allow big tracts of forest to develop into a new old growth landscape that would support these woodland species. At the same time, if we were careful about it and thinking regionally, we could identify places that would retain these open land species and could be managed in ways that are both useful for agriculture and very useful as habitat for a very different a group of species. So I'm very sympathetic to the kind of pressures that are being put upon you for management of your own land, as it's happening all around us and the eastern U.S.
Interesting. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We'll go to next caller. This is Champagne and line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
First of all, I think you have a very germane topic and one that is very appropriate locally at this time. Are you on campus? And are you speaking?
No. He's at Harvard.
Okay.
It sounds like he's here in the studio with us because we've got a good connection button. But,
okay.
He's on the East Coast.
Then let me say that there is a huge debate at the moment about the University of Illinois is very near to Urbana, and Urbana's only forested area was a 10-square-mile big grove. And there's quite a debate because we put in a Walmart and we run perhaps a 130 fairly straight north through this sort of area. And so I wanted to remind people that there's all the same sort of concerns running a little later than yours in this area where we didn't have a lot of forested area, and we do have Prairie. I want to applaud the University of Illinois for trying to put in 1,500 acres of prairie at Alton Park for just the same reasons as you've been discussing, the fact that forest birds don't stay in forests, they move out into prairies and do that sort of thing. But it needs a lot of education to bring people to the realization that this is a little of what we have, and there's not much more that we can institute, so sometimes we have to recreate it, and sometimes we have to manage it. At the moment, we have a gazillion more deer than we ever need, and they are very deleterious to some of these areas. But appreciate your conversation, and thank you very much.
Okay, well, I appreciate the call. I don't know if you want to pick up on any of the things that the caller mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, in a sense, I'd like to pull the various callers' comments together.
Sure.
Without any doubt, the most pressing concern is the conversion of any type of native habitat into humanized landscape. And we very clearly need to direct that, focus that, contain that to the greatest extent we can. Having then created conservation lands and protected landscapes of a variety of types, we then have all these questions and all these options as to how they might be managed. And what we're seeing from the last two callers is this tension that exists out there. In the one hand, it exists because people are loath to manage, and yet humans and wildlife manage landscapes all the time. The other reason the tension exists is because nature is pushing many of our landscapes that are open into forests, and as a consequence, we're losing species that and perspectives and views that we enjoy. And so it lends itself some very interesting and different conservation discussions. Hmm.
We are heading into our last 15 minutes, and I'd like to introduce again our guest for anyone who might happen to have tuned in recently. We're talking with David Foster. He's a Harvard University scientist who studies historical changes in forests, things that are the result both of nature and human activity. He is the director of the Harvard Forest, which is an area in western Massachusetts that was set aside by the university back in 1907 as a place to do forest research and education. He is one of the contributors, Time, The Environmental Consequences of 1,000 Years of Change in New England. It's published by the Yale University Press. We thought it would be an opportunity to not only talk a little bit about the Northeast, about New England, but also try to generalize and see what sort of things we can understand by undertaking these kind of long studies and what you can learn about managing resources today. That's kind of the idea. Question two, we have a couple more people here who are waiting. 339455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Go to over to Terre Haute in Indiana, line two. Hello.
Hello, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
Your comments about the hurricane prompted my call. I live in the so-called Hardwick. We had some extreme wind conditions here several times. And the amazing thing to me was it wasn't the old decrepit trees or the over-mature trees. It was the intermediate ones that were torn up by the windstorms.
And that's not an uncommon observation, because oftentimes some of the older trees have, for a variety of reasons, either because they've actually lived through a variety of stresses and disturbances that they've become more firm and resistant to them, or because they're different species, they oftentimes will survive better through a new disturbance than will the younger, intermediate trees in the same forest.
Or their crowns aren't as large in comparison to their size, so they don't blow over as readily.
Yeah, that's right.
Or damage and the like. It was rather interesting. It was almost exclusively the trees I would have liked to have seen blow down stood up, and the ones that I wanted to preserve are gone.
Well, in the 1938 hurricane, the single most wind-thrown species, that is the one that was most susceptible to wind throw by the storm, was also the most valuable. Mm-hmm. And so we experienced exactly the same thing that you're talking about.
Interesting. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll go to another caller here. This listener is in Aurora, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I don't like to tell on myself, but I am. I remember the hurricane of 1938. I was on the East Coast at that time. It was horrendous. It was a terrible thing. There was so much fear. You know, those. I think the hurricanes are worse than our tornadoes. I really do. But my question is about birding, and I'm doing a count for Kendall County. A year count. I have for 30 years done a yearly count on May, in the first Saturday of May for the state. But this is for a year starting. We started at the first day of spring, and it'll go to spring of 2005. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see a yellow-billed cuckoo. And my question is this. Are there 10 calipers? Caterpillars around, because that's what it eats.
Oh, sure.
I mean,
yeah,
absolutely. I haven't heard about them lately.
Oh, yeah, they're definitely around. So I'm unfortunately I can't explain your lack of cuckoo observations, but there certainly are 10 caterpillars around.
The other bird I don't see much anymore is the eastern meadowlark.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of that has to do with changes in the land and the way people are managing it.
Yes, and of course I have seen as the trees, the change of the woods in 30 years that I've been counting birds. And, of course, you cry a lot, but what else can you do sometimes but plant trees in your own backyard? I don't know what the... do whatever you can do to keep the trees visible.
Well, you make a very good point, which is that most people don't see those changes. I mean, most of us don't. We go through our lives. There are very few of us who go back to the same spots year after year after year and make observations. And so the ability to do that over a 30-year period where you're looking for birds, but also looking at the landscape and then seeing how the birds are responding, is really an unusual, event. And so you've got a very, very special perspective.
Yes, and I've seen the bluebird come back, which I think is a very wonderful happening for anybody seen that. I had a bluebird trail, so. That's a wonderful thing. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. One of the things that I wanted to make sure that we at least talk a little bit about is the kind of modification of the landscape that was a result of human beings. And one thing I'd be interested in having you talk a little bit about is what human beings did before the Europeans arrived, because I think a lot of people have this idea that the indigenous people didn't really do much or didn't modify the landscape to the extent that European settlers did when they got here. And in a way, I suppose that may be true. And at the same time, they didn't just leave it alone. They did indeed make changes and with the technology that they had. And I guess that the main way of doing that would be with burning.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a very important subject. It's a very difficult subject to talk about because, like any other ecological or sociological subject, it's very complex. Before European settlement, people very certainly modified the landscape, but they did it in very different ways in very different parts of the North American landscape. So, for example, we have a large study in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico in which the Maya completely, largely, deforested the landscape and converted it to homes and gardens and cornfields. There were extensive Native American settlements and huge cornfields going up the Mississippi River, and in, of course, in different parts of the country, Native Americans modified the landscape extensively by burning. In New England, it probably was a very different situation. There was a relatively small population. It didn't get corn as a major crop until about 1000 AD, so only a few hundred years before European arrival. And so although there certainly were people in the landscape, and they certainly cleared parts of the landscape and raised a few crops on it and hunted and fished and collected organisms, they probably didn't substantially modify the landscape, certainly nothing in the way that, for example, the Maya did or some of the Mississippian people did. And so it's highly varied. But there is an important point, which is that it wasn't a depopulated landscape, and it wasn't a landscape across North America that was completely driven by natural process. And so we have to take that into account when we try to imagine where our current landscapes have come from.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that is getting a lot of attention now is the issue of climate and in ways in which human activity changes impacts on climate on a global scale. And I guess I wonder whether you can see over this period of time that we've been talking about with the Europeans coming, a lot of cutting, disappearance of forest, and over a period of about a century, I guess, as people moved on, some people moved west, people moved off the land, did other sorts of things, the forest returning, can you see an impact on the regional climate as a result of that pattern of change?
No, you can't actually observe it directly, although, and that's largely because we didn't have instrumentation out there to try to detect what are important but relatively modest changes. We can now see some changes that are occurring, you know, in the last couple of decades, but the magnitude of changes that would have occurred, say, since Henry Thoreau's time, which you'd certainly expect to have occurred as the land went from open to forest, mm-hmm. Really don't show up in any kind of a climate signal that we have.
Hmm. How about do you see, because one of the things that we've seen now is we've got pretty good records over the last 100 years, weather records, and then there are ways of making calculations past that, and the conclusion is that we've seen this average increase in global temperature over the last 100 years of something between 1 and 2 degrees Fahrenheit, mm-hmm. And people are concerned about the long-term consequences of continued increases in temperature and what that's going to mean for the environment. Have you seen over, particularly, say, over the last century or the last couple of 100 years, any sign of that kind of effect on the forest there in New England?
Yeah. Again, relative to some other longer-term changes and certainly to this deforestation, reforestation change, it's relatively modest. Mm. But you do see an impact, for example, on the length of the growing season, on the timing of arrival of particular bird species, the flowering of different species. And we're seeing a northward migration of some of the southern bird, mammal, and insect species that might have been constrained by climate. So there certainly is some indication of that. You have to ferret it out from all the other changes that people are doing to the land.
We've talked quite a bit here specifically about New England. Are there some particular lessons to be gained for the kind of study that you have done here in your region that you can take away and apply to thinking about other places, not just New England, but central Illinois, perhaps, or the Midwest, or elsewhere?
Yeah, well, I think your questions have really gotten at very general issues, which is or which include, for example, in interpreting your modern landscape, you need to look at it within its historical context. What we have today is a product of climate change, natural disturbance, and human activity. And that's true whether you're talking about the prairies or the hardwood forests or the boreal forests of Canada. When we choose to manage our land, we need to take that same kind of historical perspective because it'll show us how our land is currently changing, where it's come from, and it gives us some of the potential that we have for restoring or managing it in the past. So I think there are a lot of general lessons that come from studying any particular landscape that you can then spread across much broader regions. The final thing I'd say is that the questions that have arisen from the people who've called in are not in any way unlike the questions that would arise in New England or in other parts of the country. And so there is certainly some commonality out there.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Just great to talk.
Our guest, David Foster, he's director of the Harvard Forest at Harvard University. By the way, if you're interested in finding out more and learning about Harvard Forest, they have a website. If you have internet access, you can go there and take a look at it. And if you'd like to read more on this subject, you can look for the book that we have mentioned. David Foster, one of the editors. The book is titled Forests in Time, The Environmental Consequences of 1,000 Years of Change in New England. It's published by the Yale University Press. Also, our thanks to the folks there at Harvard for helping us set up this high-quality connection here on their end. Programming here on WILL made possible with support from the Symphonie de Cambre presenting Beethoven's Fidelio Overture, Romance No. 2 with Sherban Lupu, and Piano Concerto No. 5 with pianist Charles Rosen on Wednesday, April 7th, 7:30 in the evening, in Follinger Great Hall at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. For more information, call 333-6280. And that is it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. Next is the Afternoon Magazine. Back today as host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, the Capitol Steps Politics Takes a Holiday April Fool's Day special that follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. May wheat, 413.5, up 5.5. July, 419.75, up 4.25. May corn, 328.25, up 8.25. July, 334.5, up 9. September corn, 331, up 10.75. December corn, 328.5, up 10.75. May soybeans, 1029, up 34.